Good afternoon. Let's call this meeting of the House Health and Social Service Committee to order. The time is 3:05 on the 26th of March. Present are Representative Seaton, Representative Reinbold, Representative Tarr, Representative Keller, and myself, Representative Higgins. Let's see here. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum. Let's recognize staff. We have Butch Carver, our House Recording Secretary, Stephen Gavin, our LIO moderator, Paul Verhagen, my committee aide. If anybody needs anything, raise your hand. Paul will come out and see if we can help you with that. Any electronic devices for housekeeping purposes, we have a standing rule in this committee that if your phone rings while we're here, you owe us donuts. And we like donuts, but we still don't want you to have your phone ringing, so please turn them off as we go. All right, with that said, we'll begin. So right now, I'll entertain a motion to adopt a committee substitute for HB 53 version Y as a working document.
This is Representative Reinbold. I move to adopt committee substitute HB 5328 LS0177 /Y as our working document.
Hearing no objections, the committee substitute is before us for the purpose of discussion. And we have Representative Keller at the table already. And Mr. Pound, correct?
Correct.
All right.
Representative, thank you.
Well, if you can put yourself on record, and the table's yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing this bill. Appreciate it again. I understand, and we've talked before the committee, the chairman and I, that there's no intent of moving the bill today, and I really appreciate the careful consideration. I think it gives us opportunity for a good policy discussion, and I look forward to the day. I do ask you to help me move this bill this session if possible, if we can get the bugs out of it. My intent here, I'm Representative Wes Keller, and I'm the sponsor of HB 53, and I apologize to the record keepers and the chair. We have, and you have in front of you, two letters that oppose HB 53, one from Pharma and one from the Dennis of Alaska Political Action Committee. I respect both those groups, and like I started to say, and then I interrupted myself, I would appreciate it if we can work to try to resolve the differences and move forward in this. I've had a number of people come up to me since I sponsored this bill and either give me personal testimony of a struggle they had with addiction because of prescription or a family member, and I've really been kind of surprised. There's a big reaction there. First of all, I want to address some of the points in this in the Pharma opposition. Again, a group that I respect and work with regularly.
But Representative Keller?
Yes.
Before we do that, is it possible that you can help us the changes that you made in your committee substitute, so we understand what changes were made first? Is that, would that be, do you think that would be a little pertinent first, or do you want to do that next?
We can do that, but the reason I want to lead with this is that I think there's some misunderstanding because the letters of opposition, I think, were based on the original document, and that by alerting you and them now, as the testimony comes forward, they can have had time to consider it. So, I mean, I will do what you want, but...
No.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, great. I just want to point out that the Pharma letter starts out with the comment that they share the concern of the growing non-medical use of prescription drugs, and that is not really where the bill is going. The bill is directly focused on the use or misuse of prescription drugs illegally, the legal drugs, not the illegal. Now, don't get me wrong, it indirectly addresses the illegal abuse. And they make the statement in there, Pharma believes that all participants in the drug manufacturing and distribution system must participate in the efforts to reduce the abuse of prescription drugs. And I just want to point out that we are on the same page. That is where we're at, that's where Pharma's at, and they say so very clearly. It's just that they also say that while the intent of the legislation is to reduce non-medical use of pain medicine, that isn't quite accurate because that is not the direct intent. The direct intent is talking about the medical use, the prescription use. and the resulting addictions that have come up. Pharma makes reference to the Washington State incident, and there is anecdotal evidence where there is that this has had a negative effect. And I would just point out that we have to, that's the policy that I'm bringing before you, you know, is the struggle between, you know, something that appears to be a block between, you know, people that need the medication and, you know, and the state. In reality, though, we have another problem, and that is the raw evidence that we have out there that the addiction problem is increasing. We have a number of people that are on large doses of these opiates, and we need to deal with it. And I would just ask that Pharma would reconsider their concerns. One of the concerns they raised, for example, is that there's not any pain specialists in Alaska, not enough to take care of this. And I think our CS addresses that head on and a few other things that they raise that are a concern. Another thing I wanted to point out is that Pharma points out something that I believe is the heart and the core, and is, in my perspective, the intent of the bill, and that's on the last page of their letter at the end of the first paragraph. Therefore, education about the possibility of addiction and how to work with patients to prevent addiction would be much more beneficial. Well, that's the whole point of the whole thing. Is to, for education, I guess, is my intent, my goal, my heart, that's where we're at. You know, is let's get there. And you'll see, I think, as we go over the CS, that we do address that. There's, since Washington State went this route, there's been grants given, and there's a lot of online, very good education available for free. And we're actually trying to increase the number of pain specialists in Alaska that make use of the, as you will see in the CS, make use of some of this free education that's out there, and that's all aspects of those that are prescribing the drugs. And then on the letter, again, from the dentist, the reason I wanted to cover this one before we go over it is that there is an oversight in the bill. We made allowances for giving the dial on what level of training there should be to the AMA, and we gave that same power to the nurses, and what we forgot was the dentists, and they point that out in there, and it's a valid point that has to be picked up and fixed, and I understand that. So with that, if I could now give the floor to my staff to go over the changes.
Thank you, Representative Keller. And for the record, my name is Jim Towns, staff to Representative Keller. Essentially what we did with the P version, the Y version, you have the Y version before you as the adopted. The P version was the main collection of changes, and what happened was that there were some places where we just inadvertently missed, where things like nurse anesthetists didn't get in every paragraph, and certain 120 milligrams or more didn't get in every paragraph. So the Y version essentially fixes that from the P version, which you've had for a couple of days. What we essentially have done in the changes are, most of these are relatively small as far, but they're based on talking with the professionals that we're working with. For example, on page 3, line 3, we've added, and this also is throughout the bill, you'll find where an individual or the medical professional is allowed to designate a member of their staff to check the database. This will free up the doctor, the medical professional, to continue doing other things. And that was one of the ones they had requested, is to try to come up with a better system for checking the database to determine whether an individual was abusing the system. We've also added the language or more, because essentially by limiting it the way we had it written before, it was 120 milligrams morphine equivalent, but it didn't affect 130 milligrams morphine equivalent in the language. That is also throughout the bill, and you'll see that in several sections. In about three sections, you'll find a change. The first one you'll notice will be on page 3, line 12, where we have converted it from it's opiate in a day after 4 weeks was what we had before. It is now 6 weeks. Again, the medical professionals have been telling us that's a more realistic time frame for someone who has had a major accident or major surgery. So that makes that a little bit easier for them as well. On page 4, line 27, we start getting into the regulatory process and giving the boards, and again, this will run through several places, boards of controlling the controlling boards of the medical profession, controlling boards of the nursing association, and later on the controlling board of the pharmacy association, the ability to write regulations in order to manage their particular areas of expertise and more closely for what is a pain management specialist and isn't a pain management specialist. On page 4, line 30, we get into some, the continuing education requirements. Again, this will be up to the individual boards to determine what will be the continuing education and education requirements in order for someone to be classified as a pain management specialist. Again, on page 7, we go back as or more. 6 weeks is back there as well. Page 8, line 1, we get into pain situations. There were some concerns earlier on that I believe were also expressed in front of the committee with certain people.
Yes, sir. Representative Carr, had a question.
I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you. Sorry, I just, you were going a little bit faster than
I apologize.
Could keep up. That's all I was just going to ask if we could slow down 1 second. Because I was on the last one. On page 7, the last change you said was?
Page 7, so I'm not looking at my notes. We did the or more, or this end of 6 weeks.
Oh, it's okay.
Page
okay.
7, it's line 14 and okay. 17.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Let me re-straighten down here. Okay. On page 8, we get into some of the new language that had been requested having to do with end-of-life care, also the management of, as we understand it, cancer patients have an extreme amount of pain after they go through surgery and various procedures, and may be required to take larger doses of opiates for a longer period of time that would, and that grants them an exemption. Also on page 8, again, nurse anesthetists, we use existing statute language to define what a nurse anesthetist is. On page 9, line 28, we get into the guidelines and regulations for nurse practitioners and nurse anesthetists. On page 13, some new language is some grounds for denial. Again, as I said, there are sections in between where we've added things such as designated staff and or more throughout the bill where they were just small items that had to be fixed in order to be correct. We're on page 13, line A, where the board may deny a license. That whole process is included, which now includes the language on page 14, which is fail to check or have a designated staff member check the database. On page 16 and 17, we have the requirements for the methadone clinics. And they will be required they are not required to be involved in the pain management specialist part of this, but they will be required to provide information of their patients to the database so they may be accessed by local emergency rooms. Also, if the individual who is in the program does not have a primary care physician, the physician who was in charge of the methadone clinic will act in that capacity while the individual is under their care. And that is primarily the changes for the this version of House Bill 53. Would that answer any questions?
Well, first, I'd like to say I appreciate your hard work. Now, welcome to the medical world. And now that's what we're doing now is trying to work with everybody to see if we can't make some good legislation. And so I appreciate that. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to find out a couple things. Who does this apply to? I mean, it doesn't sound like it applies to anybody until a patient has been on more, page 3, lines 11 and 12. You've got to consult with a pain management specialist if he's taking more than 120 for a day after 6 weeks. So until 6 weeks, what is the application to a patient?
through the chair, representing the application is as you understand it apply. It does not apply. The individual can be on 120 milligrams or more morphine equivalent per day without discussing it with a pain management specialist.
Okay, and then on page 3, on line 23, it does not apply to, on line 24, management of acute pain caused by dental injury or dental surgery. Line 26, a patient who is following a tapering schedule. 27, a patient who requires treatment for acute pain that necessitates temporary escalation. Line 30, a licensed dentist has made reasonable attempts and couldn't get hold of somebody. And then on page 4, line 3, a patient whose pain and function are stable and who is on a non-escalating dose, but it can be above 120 milligrams a day. So with those exclusions, then who does it apply to? I'm having a hard time getting my head around who we've still got left in the queue. And I see those same things, you know, throughout the bill and the other sections for nurse practitioner and those kind of things. So just if we could deal with it into this one section, that would probably answer my questions. I mean, this happens to be under Dennis. But.
Through the chair, give Representative Seaton. Primarily, what we are trying to do with this is that there are situations and there are individuals who, for whatever reason, take more than 120 milligrams of opiate a day in pain relief for whatever particular, especially those who are in hospice type care or cancer patients and this and that and the other. What we're trying to do is that we have, while we're using the magic number 120 milligrams, and in all honesty, that is a magic number, I think is probably the best way of describing it from what the doctors have told me, that in some cases, some individuals are required to have more. It can be just as much based on their size and what's required, and we have to make some exceptions to the rule. And again, this just kind of relays it back to what we're looking for and let the regulations in the medical profession do the determining of what they think is a level. I mean, so you could take 120 milligrams and be completely functional. I could take 120 milligrams and be out in left field. And I think it's a case of letting the medical professionals make the decision as to whether they think that the individual needs to have consultation with a pain management specialist, and or if it's a situation where the individual is doctor shopping and the doctor thinks that someone's doctor shopping. I mean, we're trying to leave some control in the hands of the medical profession here.
I guess I'm trying to figure out, Mr. Chairman, can I
follow up?
Thank you. What I'm trying to figure out is the scope of patients that this really applies to. I mean, I thought in the bill, at least in one of the previous versions that I read, I didn't detail in why because I've just got here, that for people in hospice care, they were exempt.
Correct.
And so when I looked at all the exemptions, including this doesn't apply till after you've prescribed for 6 weeks of 120 milligrams. If you've got 6 weeks and you're at 120 milligrams and you're doing a tapering dose, it doesn't apply.
Right.
If you have acute pain management, it doesn't apply. You know, I mean, all these things that it doesn't apply to, I'm trying to figure out what real group of patients do we have that doctors or nurse anesthesiologists or nurse anesthetist.
Through the chair. I have a problem with that word.
Where, you know, when I go through each one of these groups, I'm just trying to figure out who is left that this applies to. It sounds like it. That's what I'm trying to get to.
If I give a shot, we're trying to accommodate all the different, interests in the medical profession. And what's left, as I understand it, and the intent of the sponsor is the patient that is on an increasing dose of pain medication and is in danger of having an addiction problem because of because your body adapts to the level of opiates that you are prescribed to. Once the addiction process starts, there's a tendency to go for more. I mean, that's evidently the case because the prescription levels are pretty high. So who this is meant to apply to are those that are on an increasing dose of opiates and therefore getting into an area where their life is risked in many ways. And that we've talked about that in the past. But this 120 milligrams per day is not just a magic number. It's a number that above which there is a pretty sharp and significant increase in the number of people that have problems. I call it, doctors can help me out here when they testify, but there's a term called brittle. They become brittle after they're on a high level of opiate intake, and then they're in greater risk of death and whatever. And so when you ask what applies to, it applies to those that are getting on an increasing dose of opiates and are inadvertently being led into the trap of addiction. That's the intent.
And still I'm trying to get my hands around it. Mm-hmm. How often is it that dentists are giving people greater than 6 weeks of opiate prescriptions in Alaska for that are going to be in that category?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that's the one that you should ask the dentist, number one. Number two, that is the intent, if you remember, of the database that's being formed for reporting these kind of who gets the drugs and how much. So there's a bit of a process going on there to actually answer your question, but that'd be a better question, better asked to somebody in the field.
And Mr. Chairman, these are just questions I have on the bill, and it's fine, but if we don't ask them when you're here, I'm going to forget when the dog gets here. He's the dentist, he can answer. But anyway, well, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, you know, and we've had this conversation not with me and Representative Keller, but with TMJ or TMD disorders, which is temporal mandibular dysfunction. It's very painful to happen when you lose your joint and the capsules inside. People cannot function properly with that, and it hurts quite a bit. And they can be on pain management for a very long time until they have surgery. And even after surgeries, it really doesn't work. So, I mean, those are cases that we normally come across that we are prescribing high doses of opiates. But that doesn't happen every day. I'm just telling you it does happen, though, and it is out there. So we do see that. But mostly I refer those out to oral surgeons. Most dentists do that. They say, well, at this point you need to see an oral surgeon because they're the ones that are going to help you. And they're the ones that are going to keep you on opiates or whatever they have to do to help manage your pain to get you through that. But it does happen, so and it's more than 6 weeks too. So that is a concern of ours. So anyhow, did I answer your question? Kind of.
Yeah, I'm just trying to find out how broad the problem is and how many people that the dentists are going to see in a year that they are having over 6 weeks of 120 milligrams.
You know, in my experience, I'm not going to see it, but maybe one or two a year in that. But, you know, times that by how many dentists there are in the state or that we're dealing with. But it does happen whenever I have someone that's chronic like that, that has chronic pain. Like I said, if I've tried everything that I know how to do, then I refer them to the oral surgery for pronathic or retronathic surgery or of some sort. Like that, I always say when you have TMD disorders, you don't mess with that joint because sometimes it just doesn't work, and then you're in worse pain than before. So we have to be very careful with it. And sometimes pain management is the only way to deal with that, and that's just what it is in those cases. But I usually, at that point, you want a second opinion, though, and we usually work together closely with it. At least that's in the dental field.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
As we take public testimony on this, if they're, the nurse practitioners or advanced nurse practitioners or nurse anesthetists or any other category that's testifying, you know, I would like to get some kind of handle on the how often this is happening with those different professions as well. So I appreciate that.
If I could, through the chair, Representative Seaton, another person or another testifier you might ask is the department, because they keep records on the number of retirees, for example, that are on high dosage of opiates.
Representative Reinbold, you had a question?
Oh, thanks. I think this is a tough issue to talk about because we're not experts, or at least I can, you know, maybe with an exception of the dentist here that probably is an expert, but I don't want to shackle providers yet. I am really concerned. I've heard of many cases out in the community where kids will break their legs skiing and end up getting addicted to these, and it's affecting their families. So it is a serious, serious issue out there. So I'm thankful that you're willing to do, you know, to bring this issue up to talk about. I hope we haven't watered the bill down so much that it's not effective. 6 weeks seems like a whole lot of time to me. But I'm also really looking forward to getting some expert testimony that I hope that you'll bring some expert testimony, well-rounded testimony, so we can nip this. And if there's other options, which I do believe, you know, that they would be able to testify to that, to discourage the use of opiates, I think it's a wise decision, so we don't have these negative impacts on our community. So anyway, I just want to say thanks, and I'm looking forward to having more discussion about this.
Go ahead, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. just wanted to come back to one of the issues that was raised by the dentist about this database, and just if you could talk a little bit about that. I mean, I know certain part of the bill sort of relies on that being in place, and then if we don't fund that, you know, then are you going to seek adjustments to the fiscal note that would provide some funding for that portion of it, or how should we think about that portion of it?
Representative Tarr, thank you for your question. I kind of wish you hadn't asked it, but
it's okay if she wasn't. We were going to ask it. So
the database, you know, is a very useful tool, not just for opiates, but in general terms. It was there was a grant that began the program, and I discovered that the statutes read as if it's there, it's functioning, and it's in place, and I guess the reality is that it's not only not quite there, but it's a slow or it's in danger because of the funding. And I chose not to make this bill a bill that would pick up the cost of keeping that database going, because I see the use of the database as broader and bigger and more important than this bill. And I think that it's one that we as a legislature need to address. And I think that I'm just I've been unwilling to let the fiscal note reflect fixing the database bill.
Well, look, taking that still that same line of thought, though, I mean, your bill, the database is important to this bill, and if the database goes away, then your bill is moot. That's pretty much what it is, and we can ignore that fact, but it's there. And the funding for this database goes away, I think it was June 30th of this year, right? And as far as I know, it is not being funded. So, with that said, I think we have to look at that database, and either we have to figure out a way to fund it, or maybe you should consider tabling this bill until that database has been worked out, you know, because passing legislation and not having a database means we have bad legislation. You know, and it's not going to work. I mean, in my opinion, we have to figure out a way to do this database. And there's several organizations that are on board with the database. I mean, they want the database to go through. So it's not that we're going to have opposition. It's just a matter of us funding it. So, and we know where that's coming. You know, it's going to be hard to do. So I think maybe that may be a question more for the division or the department to talk about. But that's a key issue of your bill is that database. And so.
To the chair, Representative Keller, I appreciate you pointing that out. I would prefer to see the bill move forward. I think that puts more light and more pressure, more awareness of the significance of the database. That's part of the reason why I'm motivated to have it moved. However, if this committee decided to reserve action you know, until we get some more answers on the database, I would not view that as a hostile act. I understand your concerns. Very well said.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Back to one of you said, let's take page three. Section 13 is that the dentist fails to check or have a designated staff member check the database for more than 120 milligrams, but it doesn't relate to the 6 weeks. So the pain management specialist isn't required. Is the database?
through the chair, Representative Seed, would you give me a, you said page three? Or?
Page three, line five.
I'm sorry.
Okay. And now, if you would, now I'm with you, if you would restate the question.
Yeah, in this new subsection 13, it's a grounds for discipline, suspension, revoking of license if they fail to check or have the designated staff member check the database before prescribing the dosage. In the next section, section two, it's talking about this seemed to go into effect if someone was on 120 milligrams a day after 6 weeks. So I just want to get clear, is section 13 required of the dentist, regardless of whether you're hitting that six-week time frame? Are they totally independent? One is you get your license revoked, even though the section two says that this is required for pain management specialists and all if it's over 6 weeks.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, there may be some clarification language needed. The intent, as I understand it, the idea is you don't just indiscriminately, prescribe if you don't know the level that the patient is taking. So if they're 120 milligrams 6 weeks or not, and you're making a prescription, you have to make a good faith effort, in my mind, to find out, why this person wants such a large dose prescription. If you don't know, but if they're under the care of a physician, then there may be, and there evidently is, very good reason sometimes to be carry this on for 6 weeks and even more. But it just so there is a distinction there in my mind between the two. So as far as the consequence to the license, it just seems to me like there ought to be a consequence if the treating physician would prescribe such a high level without checking to see if that was a situation, what's going on with the patient here.
Okay, so I just wanted to clarify because it seems to be two things. And so this 120 milligrams a day for 6 weeks is pain, you have to go to a pain management specialist. But if you're a dentist, before you can write a prescription for a patient that's in pain because you just had this operation, you have to go to the database and verify something from the database. I mean, I'm not sure what you check, I guess. I mean, if you're a dentist and you got somebody in pain that because you operated on their jaw, I'm not sure. I'm trying to figure out what the database is supposed to do.
Just to clarify, it's not just dentists. It's everybody. Page three is dentists, right? But we're making it sound like just dentists have to do this. No, they all have to do it. It's in the bill. I mean, everyone that does this has got to check that database. That's why I was saying the database is key to this bill. And without a database, we don't have a bill, pretty much, in my opinion. So, because everyone has to do it. And from my reading this, and maybe I can help clear that up, is if I'm going to give a prescription of more than 120 milligrams open, I have to check the database to make sure that you're not going somewhere else and you're not shopping around, you see. So if I was to write you out a script today, I would call, or I'll check on the database. You go, yep, looks like we're doing good. And then, however the database works. And then that's what you would do, too, if you're a physician. you would check the database before you write the script. So it's not just after 6 weeks you have to do the database. You would do it every time you write the script, right? Am I correct on that?
That's the way I understand it.
Okay, yeah. And then after 6 weeks of me writing scripts, then I have to go to a pain management specialist before I can write another script or get a second opinion. From my understanding, that's the intent, right? Okay.
I just wanted to clarify because there were these two different things, and I wanted to make sure that I was reading the bill correctly.
Now, you know, another question, you know, we look at page 10, line 8. What we're doing here in this section is we're adopting regulations to define the procedures for a board to approve advanced nurse practitioners or as a pain management specialist. So that's what these are. But on D, my question with that is, a current practice at least 30% of which consists of direct provisions of pain management care. How do we do that? How are you proposing that these guys tell you that they're at least doing 30%, and then where did you get the 30% number to from? Why is it not 10% or 50%, or how'd you come to 30%?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chair, this was one of the ones that originally came out of the medical side of it, that there are individuals out there who work approximately 30% of their time doing pain management, and that this was just kind of a benchmark location of where they are actually devoting enough time that they are spending the time to take care of that situation and have a grasp of what they're doing.
Is that through coding that they're able to tell you that that's how they're doing 30% of their patients are on pain management?
Through the chair, I imagine it's something that they respond back to board questions. Okay. I'm not sure how the board has it set up.
Okay.
If I could, Mr. Chair, on that point, it is our understanding and our intent here to give discretion to the boards to set appropriate and responsible levels. If you look at C, for example, it's talking about receiving the continuing education in an amount specified by the board. So the dial is given to these various boards to be able to adjust, just exactly what the level of training is and what's appropriate. It's a good faith effort. We're anticipating a good faith effort by the boards to help us stop the increase of addiction related opiates.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm not sure what D does. I mean, I see on page 9, number 11, is this allows the board to adopt regulations that define the procedure for the board to approve. One of these is pain management specialists. But then number A on page 10 is that they have to have a certification in pain management from a credentialing agency. And then they have to have a minimum of 3 years of clinical experience in pain management and receive continuing education. And I guess the question is, what is the reason for saying someone that has a certification in pain management, has 3 years of clinical experience, has received the continuing education, but by the way, you can't be a pain management specialist because you're not in a practice that is at least 30% pain management? I guess I don't understand the reasoning for that one.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. Yeah, thanks. And again, if you would ask the the professionals that are in the field when they come forward, and I'm sure open to adjustment on that.
Any more questions from the committee? Well, with that, we're going to go to our phones then. Thank you, Representative Keller, Mr. Pound. Appreciate being on the hot seat. Don't go far. We might put you back.
This seems to be just as hot right here.
Well,
that's
what we do.
Yeah. Well, let's do people in the room first.
Doctors. Do the doctors.
Let's see.
We're going to take a brief at ease for a moment. back to order again. We're going to go to the lines. And so we have a Marjorie Powell. She's in Washington, D.C. from Pharma. Are you there, Marjorie?
Yes, this is Marjorie Powell. Can you hear me on this?
Well, we can.
On my earpiece, or should I go directly to the landline?
I think we can hear you fine, everyone. Yeah, we can hear you fine, so go ahead.
All right. I am Marjorie Powell. I'm a senior assistant general counsel at Pharma. So I represent the women and the men who are bringing new medicines to market. You may have guessed from my title that I am a lawyer. I am not a medical specialist. But I've been listening to all of the medical discussion, and I've listened to the bill sponsor's description of how the pharma letter was not directly on point on some things. I'd like to just make a couple of points that are set out in the letter and a couple of additional points that are based on the earlier discussion that I've been listening to. Pharma is concerned when anyone abuses prescription medicines, especially when those patients who, for whom they've been prescribed to deal with either temporary pain or permanent pain become addicted and abuse medications. There are a variety of reasons why patients are prescribed medicine. Some of them are for temporary pain, like dental surgery, as you've heard about. Some of them are for continuing or chronic pain. Now, some of the chronic pain results in patients being on stable doses of medications, but over time, patients may become more and more accustomed to a consistent dose and need an increase in dosage of medication. But it's been a major concern of the pharmaceutical industry for several years that there is not consistent provider education about how to identify those individuals who may have a tendency to become addicted, how to deal with those patients who may become addicted, and how to treat them in a way that helps them prevent the development of addiction. So we've been concerned, and we've been working with a number of groups to help develop provider education materials, provider education that focuses not just on doctors, but on nurse practitioners, on everybody within the healthcare system who might be prescribing pain medications or other medications to which people become addicted. And we think it's vitally important that all of the people within the healthcare system have a series of educational experiences to help them deal with how do I prescribe when a patient is in pain, how do I identify those patients who might become addicted, and what do I do, how do I work with them. There are a number of techniques that pain specialists have worked out, but they can be applied by a general practitioner in any kind of setting, if the general practitioner or the nurse practitioner has the appropriate education and the appropriate support. It's been our experience as we've worked with state. Let me back up and point out that we help support the National Governors Association policy clinic that has been looking at the issue of abuse of prescription drugs. And in a number of states, they've found that it's important to develop educational materials for all of their healthcare providers, not just for pain specialists, so that the general practitioner who is dealing with a patient who is in pain also knows what the signs are of addiction, how to use the database to identify a patient who may be receiving too much pain medication from too many different sources, and what to do with the patient in that kind of situation. So we would recommend that before the state of Alaska starts focusing on sending patients to a limited number of pain specialists. It's my understanding from a variety of databases that there are only something like 18 accredited pain specialists in Alaska, and most of those are in Anchorage. But from my limited experience of Alaska, and I admit I've not been there more than 3 or 4 times, there is a huge portion of Alaskans who wouldn't have access to pain specialists who are in Anchorage, that it might be more appropriate to start with a more general requirement that all healthcare providers take some education in how to identify patients at risk of addiction and how to work with those patients, some of the techniques that doctors and nurse practitioners have in other places found to be helpful. We also think it's important that patients have access to abuse deterrent formulations of medications, and the members of the pharmaceutical industry are doing a lot of research to develop new abuse-resistant formulations and to get both existing and new medications approved in abuse-resistant formulations so that they are much more difficult for patients to abuse. I know too many teenagers who would take it as a direct challenge to try and abuse medication if I said that they were totally abuse-resistant. But companies do talk about formulations being more difficult to abuse, more resistant to abuse. But I'd like to come back to the database issue, because that in states that have operating databases, where particularly where somebody other than the prescriber, somebody else within the practice, can go into the database and pull up a report about patients before they come in, or so that it's in the patient's record when the prescriber is seeing the patient, they have found that to be very helpful in identifying patients who may be, in fact, coming to a doctor just to try and get a pain medication because they've become addicted. One of the problems with databases in many of the states, though, is that the Veterans Affairs data information about prescriptions is not currently included in any database because there's a federal regulation that the Department of Veterans Affairs has read as prohibiting them from providing data for the prescription drug monitoring databases. And they are in the process of trying to fix that and be able to allow their prescribing information to go into various state prescription monitoring databases. And that will go a long way to making those databases much more helpful. But frankly, they're only helpful if everybody looks at the information, which does mean that you need to have some kind of secure funding stream to keep the database operational. And you need to have the information that's updated very frequently. In some states, those databases are only updated once a week, and that doesn't provide current enough information. But rather than start with a requirement that all patients who've been on medications for a period of time, or who, for whatever reason, need to move to a higher dose of a medication, have to consult with a pain specialist, it, from our perspective, would be more appropriate to start by providing more education, more continuing medical education to everybody in the healthcare system about how to deal with patients' long-term pain and how to identify patients who may be at risk of abuse. And let me just add one more thing and then stop and ask if there are any questions. I said at the beginning that I'm not a healthcare provider, but I actually have 3 family members, all of whom are taking pain medications, have been taking pain medications for a long period of time, all of whom have chronic pain for three very different reasons, all of whom under this legislation would have to go see a pain specialist for at least two of those family members. Getting to a pain specialist would be very difficult, in part because traveling when you're in pain can be excruciating. And in two cases, getting from their home to a pain specialist would necessarily involve travel. So let me stop and see if there are any questions that I can address.
Any questions?
Thank you, Marjorie. There's no questions. We appreciate your time and your testimony, and maybe as we continue to go down this road, we will hear from you again.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Leslie DeRay from Sandpoint, are you there? Leslie?
Hi, yes, it's Leslie DeGeri. Yes.
DeGeri, okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thanks for the opportunity. I'll have to say connectivity issues and with the phone and delays. I may speak over you and I apologize. That's just reality out here in the bush. And that's really what I wanted to touch on, was some of the reality of my experiences having working as a nurse practitioner out here in Sandpoint, out in the bush. Specifically, looking at what services we have available to our community members here. In this region, when a patient needs hospitalization or diagnostic testing, referrals, specialty visits and services, we have but one facility that we work with up in Anchorage. And unless they have third-party insurance, which is not the case actually for an overwhelming majority of our community members, this really is our only avenue. So the hospital is limited by the number of specialists, support staff, services, resources, which really does negatively impact the access to care for our members and can result in delay in treatment. And I'm looking at some of the 6 weeks in one day and 6 weeks in one day requirements here. Even if I have a patient that's requiring a higher dose or I anticipate it being a higher dose over that 6 week, one day period, even if I put in a referral request to a pain specialist day one, by the time I got to 6 weeks and one day, it's probably still not going to, you know, there's no appointment on the horizon. I mean, for us, we're looking at 12 weeks plus to get in to see services, get in to see specialists. The reality is really long wait times, even for diagnostic testing, MRIs, long wait times for referrals for orthopedics, surgery, or other services and specialists. So that the that one piece about the consultation requirements may really further limit the access to care due to the availability, not only with the limited resources and the time. I just see it from my point of view. We're looking at possible delays in treatment, inadequate pain management, associated depression, increase in revisits. I think that was really my focus, and I agree with a couple of the other points about the database as well. But that was really the focus I had when I read that, my understanding and how it affects us here in the bush. Thank you for this opportunity.
You're welcome. Any questions for? Thank you for your time. Pat in Anchorage from the Alaska Nurses Association, are you on?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for this opportunity to speak on this bill again. We are thankful that nurse anesthetists have been included in this new committee substitute, since they are commonly pain management specialists, and as has been pointed out, in four boroughs in the state, they are the only anesthesia care that is provided. I agree, actually, with many of the points that were brought out by pharma, which is not always the case. I think places like South Central Foundation Clinic is trying to move to have pain management as be part of their all of their primary care providers' responsibility, and providing training for all people that have DEA numbers in pain management would be a very good way to go. I know in New Mexico, there are regulations for nurse practitioners that do require a certain amount of pain management continuing education each year. The Nurses Association has always been on board in supporting the prescription drug monitoring system. We noticed that in this, we are thankful that the requirement for consulting this database has been reduced. So I think a lot of practitioners will actually use it more than is required by this bill. If we are going to have delegated people accessing the prescription drug database, they should have their own access code. So if they decide to go on a machine expedition for people's personal data, it can be traced to them rather than to us who are the providers. Over the issue of continued funding for the prescription drug database, there has been a discussion of putting the burden, this $160,000 a year burden, onto licensees, and the Department of Commerce thinks there are about 4,000 of us that might be involved in this, which I figure for our two-year licensing term would be about an $80 additional expense to us, just so you know some of the discussions that are going on. I think it maybe should be a split responsibility between the prescribers and maybe public protection from some other department. And those are my comments for now.
Any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the criteria there for the board to certify somebody is that they're participating in a current practice which is at least 30% consists of direct provision of pain management care. Does that provision seem to be something that you would support staying in the bill, or do you think that the other provisions, that's certification as a pain management specialist by an accreditation agency, a minimum of 3 years clinical practice and receiving continuing education, do those other three cover the bases for the situation of getting certification?
I do agree with you that maybe that requirement should be reduced. If we take the nurse anesthetist as an example, the rural nurse anesthetist may see pain patients only as 10% of their total caseload, and we wouldn't want to have them not be able to provide this. The same with our oral surgeons. Pain patients may not be 30% of the oral surgeon's practice, and so I would be in favor of eliminating that requirement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Pat, thank you for your time and your testimony. As a licensed dentist in the state, I can't speak for all dentists, but I know anytime they talk about raising our fees or our licenses, we always say no. So I'm pretty sure the medical community also, but I guess we'll be having that discussion. I know the database is important, and we got to figure out a way to fund it. You know, I've had people come into my office this last week saying they need stuff for education, and what's $30 million? We can do that, but yeah, we're having a hard time funding $160,000 for a database. But anyways, thank you for your time. Do we have Dr. Chandler online from the Pain Clinic, AA Pain Clinic?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Well, thanks for asking me back. I had several letters pushing me back into this seat that I really am trying to get out of. But I did, I think Laura beat me up initially to make me do this. What I did this time is I asked for help, and I brought this to the providers in our clinic and a few others, and I asked for input as to what they thought about this bill. And I got information back from not only my providers, but also from the physician's assistants, of which we have one or two that work with us that are actually involved in a broad spectrum of the PAs and can get information back. I got nothing back that was good, but I didn't anticipate that I would, because I asked for problems or criticisms, but I've got 50 different things that are addressed in the bill that are problems that they perceive in a negative form. And really, there's too many things to go through. But the question comes as to the outcome of unexpected consequences that this bill will have. Washington has had the bill in effect essentially that parallels this, and it's my understanding from some reading and also from information that a lot of problems that they have we need to resolve before we address something like this in the broad spectrum. The other thing that I said the first time that I was here was that you should put a sunset in this, because if you don't, it's going to become law, and then even if you have no database to work from, you have no way to get rid of it except to start all over again. Last time we put a database in place, I worked closely with the DEA, with Terry Marquardt, and a whole group of people trying to get this done, and had funding from several pharma groups, and then there was no funding. So then we had to try to set it up, and then we had no mechanism to do it. I think this is your most critical problem that you need to address before instituting something like this. If you don't have a scorecard, you sure can't play the game. So I'm really concerned about that as being the underpinning for this whole process. And moving this into law without some secured mechanism to find the information that we're required by law to look at is going to be like 1974 when I tried to practice and get medical insurance and there was none available, but you couldn't practice without it. I mean, it's catch-22 that should never be allowed to occur. So I think that real attention should be the details right now. I don't think this is time to pass this out of committee. I don't think it's time to move it on to the floor. I don't think it's time to get a vote, because I don't think you've got enough information yet.
All right. We have a couple of questions, Dr. Chandler. And you like to go by Joe, is that correct?
Oh, yeah, Joe's my name.
Okay. Representative Keller.
Yeah, Dr. Chandler, or Joe, thanks for calling in. Really appreciate it. I just wanted to confirm that you, whether or not you think we have a problem, you know, with the addiction and abuse related to opiates, and I think I heard you say that a positive, you know, if there is a problem, the positive approach or a way to address it is through the database, the prescription database, and I guess my question really is, first, you know, if you would confirm that we have a problem, or if you don't think there's a problem, I'd like to hear that, and then whether or not you think that we should be doing anything, if you think just the database will solve the problem, or is there other creative things that we might do to try to address it?
Well, I'd like to applaud your efforts to try to solve something that's been here since Christ came to earth. The thing is that no matter how hard you try to regulate people, there's always that group that's not going to be paying attention to you and trying to spend 24 hours, 7 days a week to find a way to get around something that you put in place or that we put in place for the good of society. The database is absolutely important. And yes, we do have a terrible addictive problem in the country. There are a group of things that we need to recognize about addiction. About 2% of the people in the population, when exposed to opioids, fall into an automatic addictive program, and that has to do with just genetic culture. That's very rare. It's fairly well documented in the Vietnam study, and when they brought back the boys from Vietnam who had been shot at for years, about 92 to 96% of those boys were on heroin when they came back, because they made them all pee in a cup when they walked back into the country. Of those, less than 2% became addicts that were difficult to deal with. Mental health, we're all thrown onto the streets 50 years ago. We have no mental health care in the country now, and that's why we have such a homeless problem. All those people that are on the streets with chronic pain, cancer, etc., are very poorly treated. The obligation we have to do in medicine, and I've been screaming this for 43 years since I started practice, is to take care of the people. My father gave over 50% of his practice away. We don't have that. We don't have that ability now because the laws that were put in place, like the VA law, that doesn't allow us to find out who is getting narcotics, like the law from Medicare that says that if I treat a patient for free, I go to jail. The things that are insane about our medical care in this country are being regulated to death. My big fear is that this may become another one. The particularly without a sunset has no way to get rid of it. If it has consequences that are severe in Bush, you know, we'll have to learn to live with them if we have this law on the books. And getting anything off the books, once it's on, is like taxes. Once they go up, it's very hard to get them to go back down.
Thank you.
Representative Reinbold.
Hey, Dr. Chandler, thanks again for coming and testifying. I am concerned, as many people are right now, about the opiate addiction. I've even heard about it in kids, you know, just breaking their leg, and I'm very, very concerned about it. I don't want to shackle the providers, but we do have to address these opiate issues. And so I'm trying to figure out, it just seems like a lot of the first-line providers don't understand the long-term consequences of that. They really are affecting a lot of families and a lot of communities right now. So, and you know how pushy patients can be. You know how persistent they can be, and they'll just go around you and go to the next and go to the next and go to the next. So I'm trying to figure out how to deal with this. We need help. We need your help. And I'm wondering if CMEs for providers are law right now. If they are going to prescribe these medications with unintended long-term consequences that are affecting our community, I believe these people should have mandatory CMEs. And I want your perspective on that.
I agree with you. The difficulty is common sense is not very common. I have patients in the bush in Alaska right now who are on, the numbers here are 120 milligrams. If you take four 30 milligram roxycodone tablets, that's 120 milligrams. I have a patient in Nome who has a total knee implanted with nickel in it, because that's the hardening agent we use, who's allergic to nickel. She's left with a leg that's going to be painful for the rest of her life. I've got three patients like this, and the amount of medications that they're taking are over 120 milligrams. The way I see this patient, because she can't come down and see me all the time, is I use Skype. Now, I don't know how many people are using Skype in the state to try to help the people that are in the bush, but that's the best that we can do. The other thing I noticed in the regulation is states that we have to have a face-to-face meeting with the primary care providers on an every 6 month basis if we have them on various agents. Well, you can imagine the guys up in Delta Junction having an eye-to-eye meeting with me, except through Skype or some other other mechanism. It's not going to happen. So I'm worried about some of the things we have in this regulation or law that may be unenforceable, unintended, and it needs a lot of evaluation. I could go through all the list of things that are in here. The one that I really like is you have to have a minimum of 3 years of experience. We get PAs that are coming out of school and they start to work with us. You have no mechanism to get them the experience they need to be able to be a provider. There are other things that are in here that have to do with the database funding. What are you going to do with that? We have Vivitrol and Suboxone that are being used to try to control some of the problems with addiction for patients. There's not a whole lot in here about those kind of things, and that was spoken to by a nice lady from Washington. The people who can't get access to our pain providers are going to have a problem. There isn't an easy answer for this, and I do recognize the necessity for trying to address these issues, but there's a reason I went to medical school. There's a reason that I think I know the best that I'm doing possible to help people, and you can't regulate common sense. Education is the key. In medical schools right now, the amount of education in pain management is somewhere between 0 and 1 week. So unless you get some kind of a change in the education process in our country, you're not going to have people coming out of medical school who are going to be educated adequately to be able to do these things. The patients with mental illnesses and the problems on the street, we're not going to address those because there's no funding for them. And so all the people that are out there with these terrible murders that we've had have all been shown to be mentally aberrant in some format. Probably are all on medications too. So we get blamed the doctors for doing these things. This is not something that I think that you can regulate and expect a good outcome. I'd really like to know what you're going to use, what specific things you're going to use to measure the effects of this bill. And then in 1 year, when it sunsets, what statistics are you going to use to say that this is an effective mechanism that we put in place and should be continued because it works? The recidivism rate for addicts at this time is between 92 and 96%. Not many people want to put money into something that fails 92 to 96% of the time. So the addiction problems in this country are not going to be solved in a quick form.
I would agree.
I don't mean to be negative, Laura, but this is a tough call you guys have.
Well, she's got another question for you.
And Dr. Chandler, you know I have utmost respect for you, but the communities are crying out. Families are crying out. They've been caught in a situation where their kids are addicted to medicines just because of a broken leg. So we're going to ask you if you could send us a list, if you can help us salvage this bill. If not, if you can help us solve this problem. You know, we can't continue to see these families crumble and these kids have in these communities, these people have problems. So, you know, even if we have to start from scratch and do a mandatory CME or something, you know, do some sort of fundraising for this database so we can help, you know, we got to deal with the problem. We can't just let it go unanswered. So we're just asking for your help, and we do appreciate you have some excellent points, and thank you.
I will be glad to help in any way I can. This is a real a very good thing you're trying to do, but a very big problem to deal with. And the families of children that are addicted, you got to remember what addiction is. I don't deal with addiction as such. I deal with people with chronic pain. And addiction is a much more difficult thing to deal with. Chronic pain problems are the people who suffer silently or loudly, whichever it may be. We've got 7,000 active patients who are taken care of. And I would venture to say that at least half of them are on a dosage of medication that's above what's required in this law. And we're the dumping grounds. When a patient is referred to us, the primary care physician usually, many times, will never see the patient back again. So we're left with dealing with primary care, too, because we have nowhere else to go, particularly if they're on Medicare, particularly if they're on no payments at all. So there's a lot more to deal with here, Laura, than just trying to solve the problem with the kids that are addicted. Addiction is a real problem throughout the country, and I don't have a good answer for it.
Representative Seaton, you had a question?
Thank you. Yes, I was just wondering if the people had submitted those 50 or so suggestions in writing to you at all, if you could forward them to us, because there's a whole lot of details there we'd like to see as well. I mean, I don't know if it's 50 or not.
I will summarize these and get them to you in writing, because these are, you can't see them. I've got TV on this side, but I've got yellow marks all up and down. All these bills were sent back to me with comments, and to be honest, I didn't have time to put them in a form that would be easy, but I will, and I'll send them to you as so you can review them.
All right. Let's go with Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Chandler, just on that last point, if you think you have roughly 7,000 patients under pain management and that half of them would be receiving prescriptions in excess of what's designated in the legislation.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Can you speak up?
Oh, I need to pull this closer. You were just mentioning that you have 7,000 patients receiving care for pain or pain management care. About half of those you suspect are receiving a prescription that's in excess, I guess, of the 120 milligrams is what you're suggesting. And just wondering if you just, you know, off the top of your head, have an idea of how many of the 3,500 then in that group are actually under long-term care management rather than, you know, a short-term problem that's being addressed by a higher dosage.
I'd say almost 100% of them are.
Representative Teller.
Yeah. Again, thanks, and I just want to echo Representative Seaton's request on getting those comments to us. But there is one thing I would like to correct on the record, just so there's no confusion. You made a statement that somebody that had just got out of school has no way of getting the experience. That's a in a list of things that can qualify you to be a pain management specialist. You probably didn't have the CS maybe in front of you, I don't know. But just to give you an example, on page 5, I think that's the one that has to do with AMA, the physician's assistant that you talked about right at the top there. The operating word there that makes this is the word or in on line 10. And the first one there is a certification in pain management care by a credentialing agency or organization acceptable to the board. And the second one is a minimum of 3 years clinical experience. This is the one you referenced, acceptable to the board in pain management care setting. And the third one is received continuing education by mail, by telephone, by electronic means, or in person in pain management in an amount specified by the board or a current practice, at least 30% of which. So it leaves a broad discretion to the board. It is not as limiting as what it sounded like in your testimony on the record, and I just wanted to point it out.
Well, one of my partners, Moe, mentioned that he thought that anybody who was a pain specialist as such should have a minimum of 50% or more of their practice involved in pain. So there's a great swing in this, too.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, there's no more questions. Dr. Chandler, first, I appreciate you coming online, and I know that you're trying to get off the hot seat here, but unfortunately, we'll probably bring you back more times than you'd probably like to, but we value your testimony and your experience in this area. So with that, we're going to let you go, and then make sure you get all that information. You can send it to my office if you'd like. You know, I'm Chair of Hess, and you can just call us, and we'll give you that information offline. But thank you once again. All right, do we have Judith Dearborn in Fairbanks?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I originally wanted to testify today mainly because I testified back in January. I'm the president of Alaska Association of Nurse Anesthetists, and the working version of that bill had just come out like just the day before that original hearing, and nurse anesthetists originally weren't included, but have managed to be included along with the nurse practitioners now, and I was calling today just to thank you for listening to those requests we had made and following through with all of that. And I don't know if I can be of any more assistance, but I think you've come to the discussion here that I've just heard about the part where how the Board of Nursing will delineate the qualifications of a pain management specialist, and the discussion about the percentage of patients versus education. There is that or clause in there, but I think I would like to point out that nurse anesthetists are more practiced in acute pain management, but we are now recognized as chronic pain management providers in the state by statute and scope of practice that originally got decided late last year, the end of 2012. I think I mentioned this in testimony in January. However, I just would be glad to be of any assistance in any of the nursing questions that I could help with. But again, mainly wanted to thank you for adding nurse anesthetists to the bill, along with the nurse practitioners. Thank you.
Thank you, Judith. Any questions? No? Well, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so are you saying in its current form, with those issues addressed, you support the bill?
I pretty much have we've just been trying to get included in being possibly included in this. We agree that there should be something perhaps done, but along with all the other testimony that we're hearing, we have some concerns and do believe that this needs to be looked at a little bit more carefully and clearly before it gets moved on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judith. Eva in Anchorage, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. My name is Eva Spassa. I'm a family nurse practitioner. I live here in Anchorage. I'm a member of the Alaska Nurse Practitioner Association and the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. I work in family practice and emergency and in the emergency room. Nurse practitioners in the state, as you know, provide a lot of primary care, particularly in the rural areas. We do see a lot of chronic pain patients. How many a certain practitioner sees would vary depending on their individual practice. I have a few specific comments about the bill as it currently is. Obviously, it's already been mentioned that it would be difficult to access pain management specialists in this state due to limited numbers and the rural nature of our state. Another big issue that I think needs to be addressed is how will these people be reimbursed for their services? If you're doing a telephonic consultation, there needs to be a way for that to be reimbursed, or there will be no interest in them helping you out with that. Do we have any, is there any data out there, and this may be something we could look to Washington for, as to what kind of costs there are involved in implementing this program? What kind of costs are, you know, will be increased with Medicare programs, or, you know, the requirement for another specialist to be visited? There are definitely some issues around the database. Obviously, if it ends in June, a lot of what's going on with this program won't be applicable, because if you don't have access to that data, you really don't have any way to check. There are a couple things there. Also, the requirement currently is only that it be updated once a month, which is not nearly often enough in my experience, particularly in the emergency room. You will see people coming in frequently, sometimes to two different facilities in the same day. Sometimes they'll be seeing more than one practitioner. They'll be going to separate pharmacies. There's almost no way currently for you to tell that that's happening. And it's very, very time consuming to try to call around to pharmacies to see if this person's been to more than one. So the database is critical, but it needs to be updated more than monthly. Also, the issue of the designee, that is not currently in the database as far as someone who can get into it. And I do agree that if you have a designee, they need to have their own sign on. We also would like to know who would be considered a person who should be that. Should it be a nurse, CMA, could it be the receptionist in the office? I think those are issues that would need to be looked at. There's also a conflict with the database rule saying that nothing in that section requires or obligates the dispenser or practitioner to access or check the database before dispensing, prescribing, or administering or providing medical care to a person. That would be in conflict with this new regulation. We also had a little bit of concern about penalties set forth if you don't access the database. In this working draft, and this comes, I believe, more from the statutes that are currently in effect, but for the ATN, it specifically states suspension or revocation of your license is basically is the remedy, whereas for the pharmacist or dentist, there could be other disciplinary remedies such as fines. And we feel that, obviously, it's just somehow failing to access the database one time should not really be grounds for having your whole livelihood taken away. And there are a few other issues out there. Some of these have been brought up in Washington. What happens if the treating prescriber does not agree with the recommendation of the pain specialist? You know, the treating prescriber may know this patient much in more depth than the pain specialist does. Also, what about patients who've been on a similar dose of 120 milligrams or more, and they've been on this for a long period of time? Will these patients need to then go to a pain specialist, or will they be grandfathered in if they're on a stable and non-escalating dose? And another question would be, what is considered a reasonable attempt to obtain a consultation? You know, there are just some little nitty-gritty issues and things that, you know, we feel would be best worked out. We, as a group, do feel that there is a problem with abuse of these medications in Alaska, and would like to have some things to help with that. This database is a good place to start if we could get that going and keep it funded.
Eva, don't mean to interrupt, but is there a way that you can write all those things that you said and send them to our office so we can give them out to the committee. That would be helpful.
But I already have it written up.
Okay.
Didn't know where to send it.
All right. Well, we'll you can just send it to my office, Representative Higgins, you know, in Juneau here, and we'll go from there with that. But that would be helpful, and we'll get that out to all the committee members, and especially we'll get it out to Representative Keller, and he can look it over for us. The purpose behind our testimony today is to find the areas that we're short on and maybe tweak this bill up so we can do something with it. So thank you once again for your time, and we appreciate that.
Thank you.
Oh, we have a question. I'm sorry. Representative Seaton.
It's not a question. I just wanted to relate to one of the sections of the bill on page 16 there to draw attention to it before we leave today. But if you have more people or you want fine. I didn't want to interrupt. I thought you were at the end.
Not quite at the end yet.
Okay.
Eva, thanks for your time. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify? Now, I know we have a couple of people in from the division that are online. I'm not exactly sure who to ask this question to, if there's somebody sitting in here or online on the database. Who is in control of the database? Come on up. What's your name on record for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Don Habiger, and I'm Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. I'm part of the division that gets to raise the fees on licensees when there needs to be adjustments in programs, and that's sort of what this is falling under. The prescription drug database falls under the Board of Pharmacy. It is going to actually sunset. Excuse me, the federal grant money actually will run out August 31st. So let me be clear about that right away. So once that is done, or the federal funding is done, we're required by statute to notify, or the Board of Pharmacy is required by statute to notify the legislature, which they have done this go around. They sent a report out earlier this year to say that the funding will cease. At that point in time, the Board of Pharmacy, there are a couple of options out there that seem to take place upon that. One is that it's an unfunded mandate, and the Board of Pharmacy has informed the division that they do not wish to support that activity through licensing fees, something you, Mr. Chair, understand.
Yeah.
The second thing is, according to our free-ranging statutes in Title VIII, we cannot share that cost across programs the way that statute is written. It is clear to us that a program has to be self-funded. In other words, if a program falls under a particular board of pharmacy, then it's those licensees that share or pick up those expenses or those costs. And it's difficult for us, for example, to expand that to other user groups. For example, Chapter 64 or the doctors, dentists, if you will. So those are some of the hurdles that we see in kind of transitioning from where we're at to keep the database moving forward. All that to say that if there are no changes, it looks like the program will cease at the end of August.
Okay. Well, you've answered my question. Any questions? No.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I can appreciate the position the pharmacist would be in to shoulder the burden of the costs associated with continuation of the database. If that was instead change to be spread across the licensing fees of, you know, all of the folks that would fit into the category of healthcare providers, do you think that would be a different scenario in terms of, you know, maybe making it a much less of a cost issue?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that would be a discussion Well, let me put it this way. If we do that, number one, you'd have to change 08, 01, 065 to allow us to do that. So that would be one change. The second thing is that would be another discussion with the remainder of the licensees that you choose to target, for example, dentists, and whether they would accept that.
I've already said no.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm on record. Representative Seaton. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 16 of the Y version, we start on line 9 with administration of opiates and consultation, and this is a professional who oversees administration of an opiate for treatment of drug abuse. And then on line 12 of that, there is to establish, you know, that they must have a consultation with the patient's primary care provider to establish a baseline dosage. You know, we had some information from the clinics that this is really irrelevant because, or maybe they said even illegal, because federal statutes require an initial dose of 30 milligrams. So what, you know, if federal statutes require a 30 milligram dosage, establishing a baseline dosage doesn't seem to serve the purpose. And then also on lines, section F down there, where a healthcare professional who oversees the administration of opiate of an opiate to a patient for treatment of drug abuse shall conduct an in-person consultation with the patient's primary care provider after 6 months and every 6 months thereafter. I just haven't seen very many times where you can call the primary doctor and say you have to come over here for an inpatient interview with the patient and the pain specialist. So I just don't know how that works. Maybe if there happened to be a drug treatment abuse center in the same where you had a physician, but I just don't know how that is a workable scenario. And then in H, on page 17, there we have a patient who does not have a primary care provider. The administration of the drug abuse shall do the screenings in B through D, but that doesn't take care of F. I mean, it doesn't exclude you from the requirements of F. So if a patient doesn't have a healthcare provider, he's still required to have a in-person consultation. So, and Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to, for the sponsor, point out things that in looking at the bill, we saw some conflicts that might need to be resolved. And I guess the other question that was raised in consultation with the clinics was that there's the consultation and those regulation guidelines and how those work with HIPAA requirements between those an administrator of a drug abuse program and a physician and whether they can share data back and forth. That was a question. And then the other thing under this drug abuse program was that the administrators actually said that they are a lot more expert in those amounts, and physicians come to them and consult with them on how much should be given in many cases. So I guess all of those may call into question section 19 as to whether it's applicable to the bill or whether drug abuse treatment is something different than pain management and whether it should be not treated basically as the same thing under pain management and drug abuse treatment. And so I just wanted to bring that up so that at a further hearing, maybe we'll have drug abuse treatment centers or something here and whether they're really in pain management. Or if they're not in pain management, maybe they needed
that need to be excised from the bill. And so I just want to bring that up, Mr. Chairman, before the end of the day. So thanks.
Good. Well, this bill will be back before us, so I'm going to leave public testimony open at this time. Okay. Is that all right? All right. All right. Our next House committee meeting will be at 3 p.m. on Thursday, March 28th. At that time, we are scheduled a continued hearing on HB 134, the Medicaid payment for Medicette prescription. And with that, we will adjourn. The time is now 4:43.